Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. A very good Wednesday morning to you. I'm your host, Randall White. And our big conversation today is transportation, how we get around, how we get from point A to point B. You know, last week, Uber and Lyft threatened to suspend their services as a judge had agreed with a law that states that the company's drivers need to be reclassified as employees, not contractors. The goal of that law, which was signed by Governor Gavin Newsom last year, was to extend benefits like paid sick leave and unemployment insurance to contract workers. Uber and Lyft, you may know, have continued operations. This came after an appeals court judge gave the ride-hailing companies more time to fight for their positions while still keeping drivers classified as independent contractors. Carolyn Saeed is a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle and joins us this morning to help us understand the future of Uber and Lyft and, I guess, the gig economy in California. Carolyn, great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So this all goes back to AB 5, right? Can you help us understand why the ride-hailing companies would choose to suspend service in California?
So they really, really, really do not want to reclassify the drivers as employees. AB 5 makes it much harder for companies to claim that their workers are independent contractors rather than employees. They say AB 5 doesn't apply to them, and they're going to the ballot in November with Proposition 22 to try to get voters to enshrine a permanent exemption for them. Prop 22 would keep the drivers as independent contractors, but entitle them to some earnings guarantees and some benefits. So meanwhile, Uber and Lyft do not want to set a precedent of being forced into reclassifying drivers, and they were willing to pull their service out of California rather than do so.
And that would have been a temporary pull, gambling that Prop 22 would pass?
Yes, or that they'd win in court, or, you know, who knows? I mean, I can't totally read their minds, but it was also a power play and a PR play because they did mass mailings to all their passengers and drivers in California saying, look, we're going to stop service at midnight, the stroke of midnight on Friday morning. And if you want to keep us in California, you better vote yes on Prop 22. So it was a master PR move, if nothing else.
What do the drivers want? Do they have a voice in all this?
So, the drivers can vote like everybody else. There have been a variety of polls that show that most drivers want to stay independent contractors. And there's a reason for that. Most drivers, as Uber and Lyft themselves say very often, only drive now and then. Like something like 80% of drivers drive fewer than 20 hours a week. And I think, fewer than 10 hours a week. Only about 10% of drivers drive full time. Those are the people who would be helped if AB 5 does end up applying to Uber and Lyft. Those are the people who would become employees and be hired. Uber and Lyft also say, and I believe them, that if they're forced to comply with AB 5 and make drivers employees, they would jettison, 80% of their drivers, the people who only drive now and then, because it's just not practical to hire somebody who only works 5 hours a month, and they would just go to a full-time model. So those drivers who drive full-time, though, they are a minority of the drivers, but they themselves are more interested in becoming employees and having those rights and benefits.
Circumstantially, on my part, when I use Uber and Lyft far more prior pandemic than now, but I would poll them and I would always ask them about AB 5, and I was surprised at how little they knew about it. Do you feel that the drivers fully understand what's at stake here?
That's a really good question. I have had the exact same experience. The majority of drivers really don't care. They're just doing it now and then to, make some money, and they have not followed it. And again, I think that's why the majority of drivers don't really want to be reclassified as employees. So yeah, I think most drivers have not followed this that intently, but they're starting to now because Uber and Lyft are doing all these mass emails saying vote for Prop 22 or else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what does Uber and Lyft want from their drivers? I did see some news this week that maybe they could switch to a franchise model.
So that's been floated. Uber and Lyft on the record say that their whole focus is just getting Prop 22 passed. But there have been reports that behind the scenes they're looking into a franchise model, which would it would be kind of like black car services. They would contract with services that had franchises of drivers, and so they themselves would not be the employer. Those franchises could employ the drivers. It's a little clunkier. It is actually how Uber started when we had Uber Black at the very beginning a decade ago. Mm-hmm. This definitely is not their top desire, but it's one way that they could continue to operate and comply with AB5 without actually having to hire the drivers themselves.
Carolyn, there is some legislation that the governor, Governor Gavin Newsom, said on Monday during his noontime press conference that he will sign to further refine AB5. What do we know about that? What's in that legislation?
So it's a package of more exemptions, and it's making its way through the legislature, and it should actually pass by the end of this week. It would exempt much of the music industry. Musicians invented the gig, and musicians, just operate, that really the word comes from the music industry. Musicians need to operate as gig workers. They're making the point that every time they go, do a garage band recording or play at a coffee house, they can't be hired as an employee. So it would largely exempt musicians, but not so much in Hollywood and in areas where they were already unionized. It would exempt translators and interpreters, and it would further refine the exemptions for freelance writers and photographers. Previously, AB5 said they had to be employees if they did more than 35 submissions a year to a certain company, which many can do that. I have friends who are freelancers covering the fires as photojournalists, and they've done 35 submissions in the past week. So right. It's very easy for them to top that. So it exempts those three industries largely. It doesn't really touch others. And there are many, many freelancers that I hear from all the time who are very upset about AB5 and say it has ruined their ability to make a livelihood doing everything from being, a freelance clown to, all kinds of consulting work, because companies outside California are afraid to hire them because they don't want to run afoul of the new law. So there's still, a swirl of confusion and pushback around AB5 that's not being addressed by this cleanup legislation.
But yeah, and the cleanup legislation likely will not affect the drivers.
Oh, it definitely will not affect the drivers.
No. Uh-huh. Thank you for clearing up the origin of gig, because honestly, early on, I thought because it mostly came out of Silicon Valley that it had to do with memory, gigabyte, right? But then, no, it's more like, hey, I have a gig tonight.
Exactly.
Type of thing.
Yeah, so. I think it came from the 1920s in the jazz world.
Right.
Yeah.
Carolyn Said is a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you so much for joining us today. We might have to have you back on here in the coming weeks as this evolves pretty quickly.
It'll keep us all very riveted.
All right.
So thanks so much.
Thank you, Carolyn. When the California economy shut down back in March, transit agencies reduced service to holiday levels in many cases to reflect, of course, the significant drop in ridership. Now, roughly half a year later, Sacramento Regional Transit, or SACRT, says it's ready to ramp back up to full service. Jessica Gonzalez is a spokesperson with SACRT and joins us now to explain how that might work. Hey, Jessica.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. So transit, of course, had a drop in ridership nationally, but SACRT had seen some improvements. Then the pandemic hit. What is the transit agency seeing in ridership currently?
Well, when the pandemic happened, we did see a 70% drop in ridership, which is a huge hit. But there are trans agencies across the country that saw a 90% drop. So we're trying to look at the positive in that we saw 30% of people who really still needed to ride, even during stay home orders. Over the last month, though, we have started to see a very small increase each day as we move through August. And we're expecting, as we move into the fall, to see some increased ridership. So what we wanted to do was restore our service to those pre-COVID levels to ensure that we still have room for social distancing, that people feel comfortable to ride and that they're welcome to come back.
Jessica, one of the big wins for SACRT was how much students embraced the free ridership that had been issued, what was that, last year or the year before? And of course, kids aren't going to school in person. They're learning distantly right now. So what's SACRT's plan to get ridership levels back up as long as we're in this situation where kids are learning from home?
Well, we are still focused on our younger riders because actually during the summer, we still did see kids, our teens, our Ride Free RT, you know, passes. We still saw them riding. So they were still getting around maybe to internships or different places and obviously, you know, still practicing social distancing and wearing our masks. But we still saw them, definitely not in the numbers we were seeing before COVID, because they really contributed to a huge spike in our ridership. And so as we move forward, we continue to work with our schools. We're talking now about our Ride Free Year 2 program. And so we want to continue that. We know they're the future of our riders. And so we want to keep engaged with them. But we want to make sure that everyone stays safe while doing that. So we continue to talk to the schools. We continue to monitor what's going to be happening, whether distance learning is going to be moving part-time back into school at some point. And we'll be ready to do that, especially now that we have restored our service to those pre-COVID levels. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not running our 200 series, which really contributes to a lot of those students going to the schools, but we can turn those on at a moment's notice. So if we hear schools going back, you know, tomorrow, we will be ready to do that tomorrow.
How big of a role do fares play in the operation of RT?
I mean, it's a huge piece. It's something that we're very aware that we're losing every day, but we're trying to find other ways to make up for that and look for grants and look for other funding that can help keep us moving. Obviously, a lot of people are working on the state and federal level to help transportation around the country. We're very involved in that and really keeping a close eye on what that means for our region. But we know that SACRT is a huge part of getting people around this region and moving our region forward. And so we are going to continue to do that.
It's safe to ride transit right now. I imagine some people would feel like we're supposed to socially distance and I'm not sure if I'm ready to go on a bus or a train.
Yeah, so a mask or face covering is required to ride transit. We're also blocking off certain seats to promote social distancing, so we don't want people sitting in those seats. We also have protective barriers where our operators are on our buses to keep them separated from our riders. And then we're also fogging and sanitizing our buses. So the fogging is a deep cleaning we're doing every single day for our buses and light rail vehicles, and then cleaning throughout the day. This is a huge part of what we've been doing for months now. And also we have this group of volunteers. I'm working with California volunteers, and we actually have them out at light rail stations and transit centers handing out free masks to our riders. So really we've been bringing the community together, seeing how we can get through this together. And that has been a really great part of COVID is seeing that community involvement.
Yeah, and Jessica, I have not seen any reports that show contact tracing has shown transit to be a source of any outbreaks.
No, we are not aware of that, of transit being a source, and we want to keep it that way.
So I need to ask you about the SACRT board's decision on Monday to reject a plan to build a light rail line that would have connected West Sacramento with downtown Sacramento over the Tower Bridge. What happened there?
Well, you know, we've been working on this. The cities and SACOG have been working on this for decades to really connect the Sacramento River between West Sac and Sacramento. We're continue to look at this. Staff has put considerable amount of time and work into this. The FTA has been receptive of the project. And we will continue to take a look at this project and see what the next steps may lead us to.
All right. Jessica Gonzalez, spokesperson with SACRT. Thanks for the update this morning. When do you plan to be entirely up to full speed, full service?
Well, starting on Sunday, we're going full service with a few small exceptions, but on Sunday, August 30th.
Jessica, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Up next, how has your commute changed since the pandemic hit? We'll speak with an expert with UC Davis to explain the trends we're seeing. And construction continues on high-speed rail in California. We'll hear from a woman who hosts an award-winning podcast on the topic and learn what she found out about how support has really shifted over the years. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. And a quick reminder that at any point during the show, or during the day for that matter, you can reach out to us via Twitter with the hashtag AskInsight, or I'm at Randall White and the show is at Cap Radio Insight.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And our big conversation today is transportation. When the pandemic hit, businesses, or just business in general, came to a halt in March, which left roads, buses, and trains mostly empty. Many people who were still working were doing so from home. And that has somewhat become the new normal, right, to some degree. Austin Brown is executive director of the UC Davis Policy Institute and joins us today to help us understand current commuting patterns and how those intersect with climate as well. Austin, it's good to see you as always.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me.
So what are we seeing? I know that the researchers there at UC Davis are constantly looking at these commute patterns and how we get around and that sort of thing. Have we stuck with a mostly work at home, or are we slowly migrating back to our old patterns?
So we've seen, as you mentioned, that the pandemic had really dramatic effects on when, if, and how people travel. You mentioned that a lot of people were telecommuting and staying from home. My colleagues at UC Davis have a survey now with more than 11,000 respondents, and they definitely see that. We saw that telecommuting increased from 8% before the pandemic, where 8% of people were routinely telecommuting, to where a much larger share are telecommuting now. It also exposed a really worrying repeat of history, where there's big equity differences in if people are able to telecommute. Right. So we saw that among higher income people in the survey, 50% of people shifted to telecommuting, but among lower income people, only 20% did. This is part of a bigger pattern we see in how people are impacted by the coronavirus pandemic, where the people who are most vulnerable are the ones who are least able to adapt to it. Mm-hmm. So if you have a high quality white collar job, you're more likely to keep your job. You're more likely to be able to shift to telecommuting and stay safe. Where if you have a lower pay service industry job, people were more likely to lose their job. And then if they still have to go in person.
And then once again, it falls down racial lines in many cases.
Absolutely. And this is linked into what some of your previous guests were saying, too, about transit, where many of the people who are still riding transit were doing so because they still had to get to work. So really glad to hear that transit is opening back up and that we're maybe able to resume providing high quality service to people who still need to move around.
On the bright side of people not moving around, there has to be a direct connection to the climate, and I've seen varying studies that have shown whether this was a big dent or not to greenhouse gases in California. What's the latest line of thought on that?
So it was definitely a dent. It wasn't as big as we might have hoped, in part because the modes that were the most hit were the most sustainable modes. So people stopped riding transit, those who still had to travel tended to shift into more driving. And then more worrying, as we've seen economies start to reopen, people resume travel, but they tend to resume travel in a single occupant car.
Right. Less carpooling because you don't want to be, in a shared space, the tight, confined shared space for that long, right?
That's right. Less carpooling and also less transit in some of the economies that have reopened. So we're seeing people return to that car. Well, we know that that's not a part of a sustainable solution. We know that people in single occupant cars cause more climate emissions, more air pollution, and of course, a lot more congestion. So can you imagine what the Sacramento area is going to look like if everybody returns to travel, but nobody goes back to transit and everybody instead gets on the 99 in their single occupant car?
Right. And the trucking industry, how much of a dent did they see? I imagine goods and services still needed to get around during that period.
Absolutely. Trucking was much, it didn't decline really at all. We still needed the same goods. They shifted patterns a little bit, but we saw a huge increase in at-home delivery, where more people are getting various delivery services on a daily basis, that would be that grocery delivery or package delivery. So we expect, we don't have all the data in yet, but we expect that we'll see a pretty significant uptick in those medium-duty sort of like delivery van kinds of vehicles that would go along with that increase in services. That's also why we haven't seen the drop in air pollution that many people anticipated. Trucks are responsible for much more of the air quality pollutants than cars are in California. And so since truck traffic wasn't nearly as affected, we didn't see as big of a drop in air pollutants as we might have hoped. So we're seeing, yes, there was a bit of a short-term climate benefit. Yes, there was a bit of a short-term pollution benefit. But if we just return to the old ways of doing things, and maybe even worse, we're not going to have solved any of our long-term transportation challenges.
Because trucks do contribute as much as they do to the air quality, there is a push to transition that industry to an electric fleet. How likely is that in the next decade?
I think it's looking very likely. The California Air Resources Board recently finalized a rule that will start to require manufacturers of electric trucks to sell an increasing share of electric trucks into the marketplace. And they're also beginning work on a rule that will require fleets to purchase electric trucks. So this is a lot like what California has been doing to encourage electrification of personal vehicles over the last decade. And we're anticipating really big increase in those sales to go with it. Now, in order to do so, California needs a waiver from the Environmental Protection Agency. So that'll be the big thing to watch in 2021 is how and if California is able to obtain that waiver. But if they are, we should see that California becomes really the leading marketplace in the world for electric trucks.
Austin, there's also a push to get electric vehicles into the homes, lower income homes, through a variety of different ways. I believe there are, like local versions and statewide versions. What are you seeing on those lines? And there's also the shared versions, right, with the gig cars that AAA has.
Yeah, I think that's a huge, exciting new policy area where we're trying to figure out what can California do to make sure that electric vehicles are part of an equitable transition and really provide those benefits to lower income and disadvantaged communities. So you mentioned a couple of the programs that are out there. I think California is looking into how to set some sort of an incentive to encourage people to purchase used electric vehicles. And then the big missing piece right now is ensuring they have access to charging. So you need to make sure that there's the way to charge your vehicle in an apartment building, in public charging while people are at work, because many of the people who would benefit from those vehicles don't have access to a garage or off-street parking where they can charge the vehicle.
There are several different things going on right now. The sharing of resources, the electrification of our transportation, and what's the third one? You have the three revolutions, it's called.
And automation.
And
so
automation.
As we start to see higher levels of automation in vehicles,
like self-driving,
those will interact. Self-driving.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And you're all the researchers there are constantly looking at how that's going to move forward, and it's just fascinating areas of research. Austin Brown, Executive Director of the UC Davis Policy Institute, thank you so much for the update today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. A high-speed rail line is under construction in California currently, with work being done in the Central Valley, and it is not without controversy, for sure. Costs have risen a lot since it was first proposed, and California is not the only state that's had high-speed rail plans over the years. Wisconsin wanted to build a line that would connect its main cities of Madison and Milwaukee, but that fell apart, and to some degree, its demise was to California's benefit. Bridget Bowden is with Wisconsin Public Radio and is the host of the award-winning podcast Derailed, which seriously unpacked the issue in that state. But part of the process for explaining Wisconsin's high-speed rail plans meant a trip to California to understand ours. Here's a boiled-down snippet of Derailed Episode 4.
We need to start with a little history. California had a referendum on the ballot back in 2008.
It was called Proposition 1A, and it authorized $9 billion in bonding for a high-speed rail line to connect San Francisco to Los Angeles in less than 3 hours.
Like Wisconsin, California's rail project has been a saga that's been passed from governor to governor. It was once championed by Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I believe very strongly we should have high-speed rail all over the state of California and all over the United States.
Then Democrat Jerry Brown carried the torch.
I make no bones about it. I like trains. I like high-speed trains even better.
Now, another governor, Democrat Gavin Newsom, is running the show.
Let's be real. The current project, as planned, would cost too much and respectfully take too long. There's been too little oversight and not enough transparency.
Bridget Bowden, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I listened to Derailed when it came out. It's been out for what, about a year now?
We started debuting episodes last October.
So not even a year, yeah. And I loved it and was very happy to hear that it won an award. Maybe more than that, but I did see at least one. One of the takeaways from the Derailed podcast is that high-speed rail was not initially a partisan issue. In fact, in your state, Republican Governor Tommy Thompson was a huge fan of the project.
Right. This was actually kind of a surprise for me because I had always thought of rail and especially high-speed rail as more of a Democrat priority. But when I started looking into this history, and I should say that I actually didn't live in the state of Wisconsin when all of this went down in 2009, 2010. So as I started doing research and figuring out where our high-speed rail project came from, I was really surprised to learn that it was initially championed by Republican Governor Tommy Thompson.
Yeah, and Tommy Thompson even sat on the board. I think he was the head of the board for Amtrak, right? He's a huge fan of rail.
Yeah, he was the chair of Amtrak for a number of years.
Right. And then he became Health and Human Services Secretary in the Bush administration.
That's correct.
Yeah. So what happened? When did it shift and become so partisan?
Yeah, so it's really it ties into a lot of issues that were happening at that time. So if you think back to 2008, 2009, you have the Great Recession, you have Barack Obama elected president, you have the stimulus. And so this project that Republican Governor Tommy Thompson had dreamed up, which was a high-speed rail line connecting the city of Milwaukee to Madison, which are Wisconsin's two largest cities, it eventually got funded by the stimulus, which at that point we had a Democratic governor, Jim Doyle. So, but at that point, you know, the Tea Party had started coming up, and we got a new governor, Republican Scott Walker. And as he was running for governor for his first term, he made it a priority of his to put an end to this train project. He thought that it was a boondoggle, is what he called it.
And that really stuck. That boondoggle term stuck and is even used here in California.
Really? Yeah. Definitely used about trains a lot.
Yeah, Bridget, how did Wisconsin's rejection or Scott Walker's rejection of high-speed rail end up benefiting California?
Right. So when Wisconsin canceled the project, obviously there was money from the Stimulus Act, and that went back to the federal government and then was redistributed to other states that had received money from the stimulus to go to high-speed rail, and California received the bulk of that money. So we followed the money, and I went out to California last summer to check out the construction.
Yeah. In episode 4, you mentioned that costs jump in California because the project had to be built from scratch. Can you talk a bit about that?
Right. So one thing that I want to make really clear is that the project in Wisconsin was really different than what we're seeing in California. And the main reason is because in Wisconsin, the train would have traveled along an existing rail corridor. There are already tracks there. Freight trains travel on them. But in California, it's kind of starting from scratch. It's creating a whole new rail corridor through the Central Valley. And so you have to acquire the land. You have to build the track. And that is quite a bit more complicated.
Yeah, and it's really pushed the costs up. At the end of the whole process of reporting this out, what sort of reaction did you get from people? Because this is such a well, I guess we could say a third rail and a topic to touch. What did you hear back from listeners?
Yeah, so I think the main thing we heard was surprise at how much of a political battle this had been. I'm not sure that people really understood the history of how, you know, once upon a time, a Republican governor had championed high-speed rail in our state. And in California, too, Arnold Schwarzenegger was a proponent of the high-speed rail project. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things have really changed in politics in the last 10, 15 years, how the parties relate to each other and how our country is divided along partisan lines. And I think that high-speed rail is an issue that illustrates that pretty well.
I wish we had time to get into it, but the episode about how the train cars themselves were purchased and are just sitting somewhere is... Mm-hmm. That episode is fascinating, and I'll just leave that as a tease, I guess, for for listeners to check out the podcast. But Bridget Bowden is with Wisconsin Public Radio and is the host of the podcast Derailed. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Still ahead, Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg's plan to fast-track slow streets in Sacramento. And a bicycle advocacy group joins the conversation as well with thoughts on current issues for cyclists and the future of cycling in the capital city. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation today is transportation. And when the pandemic began to shut down cities earlier this year and people were stuck in their homes for weeks on end, there was a push by several major cities, including a few in Northern California, to open up some of their streets for outdoor activities like walking or running, biking, those sorts of things. This is known as slow streets. The idea is to give people more space for social distancing and to keep them closer to home so that we weren't packing into parks and onto trails, or for that matter, spreading the virus into areas that hadn't yet seen spikes of COVID-19, some of the more rural areas of California where we're seeing that happen now. In Sacramento, those plans lingered for weeks, which turned into months. Finally, this summer, the city said it wasn't going to happen. But now, there could be some light at the end of the tunnel for those eager to initiate slow streets in the capital city. We expect to hear from Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, who needs to step out of a meeting briefly to speak with us. But to get some background on this, more than what I just gave you, is Executive Director of Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates, or SABA, Deborah Banks. Deborah, thanks for being on the show.
Happy to be here, as always. Thanks, Randall.
So you were in this process, you know, used as a sounding board, I guess, for the city. You and also Walk Sacramento helped give information as to maybe the best streets to turn into slow streets and that sort of thing. What happened there? There was like a survey done, right?
Yeah, Walk Sacramento and Saba engaged in a deep survey where we pushed it out to different neighborhoods and asked them to then get in touch with their residents. And there was mixed responses to that. Some neighborhoods did a much better job than others, et cetera. So there wasn't an even amount of responses, which didn't give us a really deep, I guess I would say, way to really identify a set of streets. And that was, I think, flawed in our approach. And what Mayor Steinberg is going to talk about, I hope, is a different model. What's one of the good things about, you know, not having done this earlier is that we've learned from some other cities, and there are now a number of different models. So now there's almost best practices on how to do slow streets. And we can now jump over, you know, our failings from the first round of this and, you know, do a really good job on it the second round.
Well, good. We can leapfrog in the best possible way exactly. Because this really has been rolled out not just cities here in California. I believe Emeryville, Oakland, San Francisco have all done this, right? But we're talking
about Los Angeles,
LA too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Worldwide.
I mean, the list is very long. Worldwide, yeah.
What are some of the problems that I guess we'll work to avoid that other cities have had?
Well, I think, again, because we were well-meaning and we were thinking, let's do this quickly as a result of the pandemic, we wanted to slow some streets right away on behalf of people, for people, to people. And that was the problem. We were doing it to them. So these new models that are starting to come out are allowing neighborhoods and organizations to come together in their own neighborhood and self-identify what streets they may want to be able to close, and then also offer up their own like neighborhood watch, if you will, to lower costs for possible policing, et cetera. So that's a really different model that's going on in Los Angeles. I think Oakland is now using something of that nature, as is New York. And it's, you know, working out pretty well. So I think we're going to move hopefully in that direction.
Deborah, I understand we have the mayor on the line now. So I want to welcome in Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. Yay. Thank you for taking time from your meeting, Mayor.
Glad to be with you, Randall.
So I understand there is a move to fast track slow streets in Sacramento. What changed?
Well, yesterday, the Climate Commission that Mayor Cabaldon and I commissioned a year and a half ago made their very bold recommendations to our city council. And, you know, I said yesterday, could there be a better day to have a discussion about the imperative of climate when people literally can't go outside because it's hard to breathe? And the recommendations are robust. They include a strong commitment to electrify our buildings in Sacramento aggressively over the next decade, to invest much more in clean mobility options. You know, yesterday we put $1 million plus into the California Mobility Center in collaboration with SMUD and Sac State. But the other key recommendations are around what we can all do as neighbors, as neighborhoods, as people of Sacramento. And this slow streets idea really rose for me close to the top, because this is something that can engage our communities to make different streets in Sacramento exclusively accessible to pedestrians, to bikers, to roller skaters, and to create that kind of community feel in many of our neighborhoods that I think people would just love, consistent with our climate goals. And so I asked that we get on this, that we model this, that we look at how we can do this without huge city expense, because if the city is doing it top down, then of course the city has got to maintain the cones and the other barriers that prevent, you know, cars. But if the neighborhoods are taking the lead, and if volunteers are stepping forward, this can be something that is done in a cost-efficient way, and in a way that the neighborhood owns. And so we'll begin really working on this. The next, you know, 45 days or so, we'll get a report back and we'll start figuring out how we might get started.
And we're likely looking at streets that already have high bicycle and foot traffic?
Yes, exactly. Streets that have high bicycle and foot traffic and streets that the neighborhood itself chooses. I think that's really important. I don't want to be engaged in something where the city is saying, we have made a decision that we are going to close your streets. This ought to come from the community up, and that's what will make it dynamic and sustaining.
I know you probably don't want to be put on a timeline, but what are we looking at, like, in terms of weeks, months?
I don't know. I mean, that's always the challenge in government, of course, which is to try to push hard and really expedite those timelines. I think we can get started with a vision, a very specific vision, within the next couple of months. And then I think we can get started maybe a few months after that. So, you know, I'm always wary of over-promising. I think we can get started over the next year on something that would be really exciting for our city.
Yeah, maybe roll it out a street at a time and see how it works.
Yeah, although, you know, you need to do it with some sort of scale, I think, if it's going to be a citywide program. Our city team recommends that you look at, you know, 20 miles at a time, but maybe that gets staged as well. All I know is that when we decide that something is important, it rises on the priority list. Just as we got $89 million of CARES Act funding out for our community over these last couple of weeks for youth, for workforce, for small businesses, for the creative economy, we're going to tackle climate. And we should, we must. I mean, this isn't one of these issues, again, that you can just say it'd be nice if we had the time to prioritize climate. Oh my God, look what is happening in real time here in Sacramento, in the state. This has got to be every bit as important as inclusive economic development, and let's get at it.
And I know you have a very short window, so I'll end with it will be important to have these streets in all neighborhoods, right? Not just in like the Midtown area.
Exactly right. You know, everything we do has got to be neighborhood centric. And yes, the central city and downtown is vitally important. It is still the economic center, but it's not the only economic center. It's not the only place. And so, yes, diversity in terms of our neighborhoods is absolutely essential.
All right. Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, we really appreciate you stepping out of that meeting for us to give us the update.
Thanks so much, Randall.
And let's turn back to Executive Director of Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates, Deborah Banks. And Deborah, I imagine you're thrilled to hear that.
Oh, man. Yeah, I was screaming last night when I heard Mayor Steinberg first have a press conference and saying that they were going to push slow streets up to the top of the a list of things to do for the Mayor's Climate Commission on change. Yeah.
So he talks about, you know, like getting a plan in place, and that I always get a little concerned when I hear things worded that way, because I know there's already been work on a plan. How much of what's already been done can fast track this?
Yeah, I actually had a bit of a conversation this morning with Jennifer Donlan Wyant, and, you know, the transportation department will be working on this. She's been thoughtful about this, you know, for months as well. And so there are some already plans in the works. She thinks maybe they'll be bringing something to city council sooner than 45 days. Again, because there are some great models out there in the world that are neighborhood centric, as the mayor discussed, we can take a look at those models, tweak them, make them work for Sacramento, and then see if we can get them into place. Here's the thing that's going to take time, and that's the engagement piece. Well, we can't just create this new program and say, okay, everybody have at it. There needs to be some education. There needs to be some awareness building. There needs to be some engaging of these communities to understand what we mean by this, what this looks like, how they would help manage this themselves, as you heard the mayor say, volunteers, et cetera, so that they feel like they, again, this isn't something that's being done to them. It really has to bubble up from the neighborhoods themselves, and that requires some solid public engagement and some thinking. And one thing that I think that is really great is that we have to move at the speed of trust. And that means in some communities, this may sail through and it'll happen fairly quickly. While in others, more conversation, more discussion, more helping to realize what it would look like before they actually activate and say, okay, let's do this in our community.
I heard you mention Jennifer Donlan Wyant. She is the city's mobility chief, right? The person who looks at all the different ways we can get people to be active.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And
then some, right? I saw you cringe a bit when I asked the mayor if they might perhaps start one street at a time. The mayor said it has to be done to scale and maybe starting with 20 miles of roads. Does that sound like a good start for you?
Well, I love the idea of 20 miles. That's so much better than what the original plan was that we looked at last May, June. And so that's thrilling. Again, it will be, though, if it's neighborhood centric, we're moving at the speed of the neighborhoods. And some will move faster. Some will take more time. Others may play around with the idea and then decide this isn't for us, where others will just, you know, dive right in. So that kind of a timeline is really going to be different. But I think setting up the program and doing the engagement, which I'm sure that I'm hoping anyway, that Saba and Walk Sacramento will also still be a part of, because we have the connections into the neighborhoods, will help move things along.
So we're talking about slow streets. There's also something called complete streets, where you have some main corridors in Sacramento, Broadway, Franklin, Stockton Boulevard, where the city is looking at reducing the number of traffic lanes, growing the sidewalks, and growing the lanes for bicycles. Where do those projects stand right now? The Broadway one, is that the farthest along?
Yeah, I believe that Broadway is the farthest along. There are five high injury identified corridors, of which you've just named three. I can't remember offhand the other ones. But the city continues working on those. They're in different stages of planning and engagement. Broadway, I think, is currently under the eye of the city, getting some work done along those lines. We are working on a grant right now to do some engagement and mobility in the Stockton area with some partners, Walk Sacramento, the city, and Veritable Good Consulting. So we're hoping to realize some dollars that we can do some engagement there. So, you know, there's a lot going on. Those things continue on. They are, you know, on their timeline. They have plans and processes, and they just continue to chug along.
Is the funding there for them? Because budgets are really being crushed.
Well, some of the funding is there for them. The city is always strapped for dollars because of our tax base. But I know that as each piece of the project moves along, there are grants that are brought in, Caltrans dollars, state tax dollars, et cetera. I mean, that's one of the things about Jennifer Donlan Wyant is that she and her crew are masters at, you know, finding grants, finding dollars to help keep things moving in a pretty strapped department.
Deborah, one addition to streets that drivers, pedestrians, cyclists have probably seen are those separated bike lanes that have been put in. I think that's the terminology for them, where the cars park on the not against the sidewalk, but against the bike lane. How have those been accepted?
They have mixed results. For people who are newer to cycling or are much more nervous about riding around in traffic, which is the majority of commuters into town, people love them. They're a little bit nervous about some of the cars that are parked close to the intersection, so that if they're turning right or trying to move out into a lane to continue forward, they're worried about cars making what's called a right hook, where the car doesn't see the cyclist emerging out of the protected bike lane because they're blinded by a car that's parked.
Uh-huh.
So the city is working on those changes to make those changes so those streets are safer. But other people who are very familiar and have no problem riding in traffic, they don't always like those protected bike lanes. They just find them to be confining and that they're not able to move around cars or pedestrians or trash piles or whatever that's right in the street. But I would say the majority of people are happy about them.
Deb, we don't have a lot of time left, but I want your thoughts on the parent company, Uber, selling off its Jump bikes to Lime. And at least currently, there are none of those bikes on the roadways. What do we expect to see there? These are the shared bikes that people can, and they're powered. When you start to pedal, it gives you a little boost.
Right. I don't know a lot about it, but here's what I'm hopeful. I have fingers crossed that they're able to create a deal and strike something that happens so that we can get bike share back on the road in Sacramento. It was a huge, wonderful program in the past. Sacramento had the second highest share of, right, of jump bikes, mm-hmm, after Paris, France, which is, you know, city of trees, hello. So,
right.
But bike share is a really important and necessary piece of our active transportation and mobility.
And SACOG will be coming to some decision, I believe, on Friday. Deborah Banks, Executive Director of the Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates, or SABA, really appreciate you taking the time to get us up to speed, right?
Thanks so much, Randall. Appreciate it.
All right, that's Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, always huge helps. Digital team Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Don't forget, the governor is at noon. See you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.